Energy Stew with Peter Roth, Thursdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and we're going to be the second coming, all of us. It's going to be some show, obviously. This is a real treat. And I'm talking actually about a book called Be the Second Coming. And it's a wonderful book. I've just loved reading it. And I'm sitting here with the author, Hope Ives Moran. Welcome, Hope.
Thank you, Peter.
It's such a treat to talk with you, because the book is so fascinating. Every part of it is just feels good. It's easy reading, because it draws you in to how beautiful your journey has been and what you have to relate and relay. Mm-hmm. Both relate and relay, because you're actually speaking from higher places that work with you. Mm-hmm. And I certainly understand that and identify with that, since I have been living as an intuitive for many, many years. And it's so fascinating to me to live in an intuitive reality where you have a mind and you also have another way of getting it. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And how did that happen to you?
How did that happen? I had a channeled reading from Martha Hamilton Snyder, where one of the questions she asked the guides was, what were my greatest gifts? And I was told at that time that I was an artist that I had no clue about, and that I was psychic. And I thought, well, wow, that's kind of cool. And she said that within 6 months I would be able to do what she does, speak to the guides. And within just a few weeks, I began communicating with my spirit guides. And so did my former husband, who I was with at the time. So it's sort of, we both were able to communicate in that way within a period of a week or so.
Now, that is something that a lot of people might not believe. It's also something that a lot of people hope for.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people out there who understand that it is something that can happen, maybe, because unless it has happened, you don't know how to hold it.
Yeah.
And it probably took you a while to even believe it when it was happening.
Well, the fact that the both of us did it at the same time helped.
Uh-huh.
The proof is in what comes through. What she taught me to do was sit down and ask, is there anything I need to know now? And I became very still, and I would just write down whatever came to me. And at first it was a phrase or a word that was very relevant in my life and helpful. And then it would be a paragraph, and a short while later it was sort of a page, and then at the end of the page the last sentence was, ask me a question. I thought, wow, who are you? You know, what's going on here? And I heard, I am your guide and teacher. And we started a dialogue after that that's been the way I live since then. That was in 1998.
And some people call that automatic writing. And I know a lot of people who actually do that. And it's fascinating when you realize that you're writing from a place that you're not thinking. It's something we're not taught in life.
No.
That we're directed to think about it, try to understand ourselves, reason about things, deduce, and then put things down on paper.
I was never good at all those things. I think my mind is sort of like a receptor of some sort, and I'm open to receiving in a way that perhaps folks that are very good at reclaiming information and stuff like that might be a very different way of having that kind of connection or that kind of relationship with life and information.
Yeah, it's so interesting when we are understanding life through a different parameter than we've been conditioned to. And there are a lot of people who will not want to give that up. They'll be afraid to. I've been teaching intuition for many, many years, and a lot of students really embrace it. They love it, and a lot of students are afraid of it. And when it starts happening, they actually want to shut it down because they don't know how to hold it. And so it takes a lot of courage, actually, to claim this hearing and this higher knowing that our minds haven't figured out. It just comes through. And we don't know always where it comes from. That's why it's fascinating when these spirits, if you're writing, these spirits actually sign off. And they give their names.
Sometimes, yeah.
Right.
When I first started, I knew my guide's names. And in the book, I speak about Shadrach, who was the first guide that I knew the name for. And that name, interestingly, had been sort of banging around in my head all my life. I didn't know anybody by that name, and I had probably heard it somewhere. But that information, that name, was always in my awareness, which was sort of curious, I thought, because obviously these spirit guides are part of who we are and part of our life already. It's just this process of channeling or automatic writing is becoming aware of them in a new sort of formal relationship of some sort, whereas casually, previously, is how it all.
There's an understanding on other dimensions that our linear minds can't hold. That has to do with the oneness and interconnectedness of all. And so these other beings maybe are part of us and we are part of them on some level of, some dimensional level that our minds can't relate to.
I think they're inextricably intertwined in who we are.
Well, let's believe that, it doesn't. I don't know how to hold that even, because we don't need to feel that way.
No, you don't need to. For me, it's the truth. Whether
right.
you choose to, you know, hold that truth or not.
Right.
It's just my experience.
For some people, it might make it easier.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I don't know who I hear from, and I'm very grateful that I hear things.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically when I hear things I couldn't know otherwise, my mind has no comprehension of or history of, and information comes through and it helps people. And so you have the same. Your work is more of an earth work. It's more of a communal work. I see from reading your book, Be the Second Coming, that it's really about the collective of who we are and where we're going and how to live in it more purely and beautifully. There's so many things in your book that are inspirational about how to be in life, how to be with nature, how to love it more, and enjoy. You have garden elves you've worked with. But tell us about that.
Yeah, I wanted to create a garden, and I had ideas about what I wanted. I wanted raised beds and such, and you know, sort of things that I was familiar with. And so I went out and I leaned against a tree in the backyard and I sort of tuned in to the energy of the place and the land, and lo and behold, the garden elf came in through me and we had a conversation which I share in the book. And the garden elf helped design the garden.
How did you know it was a garden elf?
I asked. I said, who are you? And they said they were the garden elf, and they sort of explained what their role was, you know, sort of organizing the
Saying that they said they were the garden elf.
Yeah.
Not elves, but elf.
Yeah. It's sort of, I'm sort of casual with singular and plural in those realms somehow.
Okay, I mean, good. I like that.
At one point, you know, Jesus speaks in the we or the I. It's sort of the same thing in a unity consciousness. So.
Sure. Well, you talk in the book about Christ consciousness and what that means, and it's not a Christian religion thing.
No. Christ is really one who embodies God, and that's really all of us.
Right.
You know, Jesus has the top billing, obviously, but...
And we could say that about Krishna also.
Yes, I'm sorry. Perhaps that's my perspective from the work I've been doing. And obviously, Be the Second Coming refers to...
To the understanding that
maybe... Jesus' return, yes.
Or we could have a Jewish approach to the Messiah arriving.
Absolutely. I am... Completely with you.
Okay. And the Second Coming is a coming within all of us.
Yes.
It's not some guy showing up and saying, I'm it.
No, it's allowing that higher, greater being that is within each of us to manifest through us, and then honoring that in everything and everyone we see around us.
Exactly. It's so beautiful. And I believe that's where we're going.
Me too. And hopefully that's what the book will awaken people to, is that possibility, that reality. And then, you know, it is a guidebook, so it will help people who are new to this kind of idea to walk along that path.
Sure. It's a forerunner.
Mm-hmm.
Reading your book tells me how the future is going to look for most of us. I think this is the way that we're supposed to live, being in awareness of our multidimensionality and our oneness with all, and recognizing the beauty in everything that comes from that.
Mm. It's a magical world. It's truly heaven on earth when you live in that way, and when people around you live in that way. It's absolutely magical. Because there's so much more than meets the eye. It can be very difficult to live on this earth not knowing of the verticality that is present for us and for everything around us.
The verticality of dimensionality.
Yeah, yeah.
That there are higher dimensions that we are already a part of, and many of us are not open to.
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunity is there for that open, and I believe as we're coming into 2012 and the evolution through 2012, there'll be a lot more shifting of energies that will allow people to recognize this.
I do think it's getting easier and easier. The veils seem to be thinning, the energy seems to be growing, so that it's easier and easier to connect at different levels interdimensionally.
Sounds good. All right. So if that's the case, something in your book that struck me about who's in charge.
Who's in charge? You know, that's a question I struggle with, because it can be so confusing. And the confusions of the spiritual journey for me have been because of different levels. You know, at the I'm only human level, it appears that, you know, I'm in charge and I'm making my own decisions and I'm, you know, a victim of this or a victim of that experience happening to me. Whereas as I become more aware of higher dimensions and spiritual guidance and such, I find that there is a surrender that occurs to that higher connection. And I question, you know, where the line is for myself of where hope's impetus for action is versus the guidance that comes through me. So I can't truly say for myself, you know, an answer, because it's an answer that's fluid for me as I learn to fully surrender, as I learn full embodiment of Christ consciousness. It's a process. And I bounce back and forth between, you know, my human perspective and the Christ perspective of seeing all as one, you know, unity consciousness.
It's a surrender too.
And yes, surrendering to this present moment, which allows my access to those levels.
And you talk in the book about conscious attention versus surrender.
Right.
And they actually work together, right?
Yeah, that was a really cool question to get clarified for myself, because I asked Jesus what was the relationship between surrender and conscious attention. Because I think of conscious attention as being, you know, the observer in my life, where I'm watching myself go through whatever it is I'm doing, which also creates a little space between myself and life, so I have a greater ability to respond instead of react. But what I was told was that surrender is the precursor to conscious attention. So surrendering to this present moment, surrendering to that higher aspect of myself, is a very important aspect of this whole process.
And that helps be intuitive. I know that I constantly just surrender my mind. I tell my mind to shut up and pay attention.
And does it?
Yeah, it knows better. It's learned that it doesn't know so much, but certainly whatever comes through knows a lot more.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, sometimes I tell my mind to just sit down and go in the corner. And it has this way of just popping back in sometime because it's such a busy item.
Yeah, it has an ego.
Yeah.
And so that brings me to another subject matter that I really love in your book, is love, is you know, appreciating the truth of love. Without all of the fairy tale fluff around it, it's like, what is really love, and what does it mean, and how do we hold it? And it's in your book, it's very real about that.
Yeah, that there's a section where Jesus speaks about love's many faces, and he goes through the different qualities of love. You know, the love that we're all familiar with, the lover's love, the parental love, They talk about a masochistic love, where somebody is held so tightly to a deep path of internal awareness and reflection that it appears masochistic to somebody on the outside. But the bottom line is, what is the outcome of love's action? And it creates a whole palette of possibility of what love is, beyond what we're traditionally calling love. And it's very freeing in many ways, because it even goes to the point of saying it could be love to, say, defend your house, your land, your family from somebody who would take it away, because in taking it away, they would take away your ability to love in that place in the way you would like. And then at the end, he goes into the clarity of saying, you know, this isn't a ticket to say, do what you wish and call it love. Do anything you wish and call it love. But love's action is really, you know, what happens as a result of this action, and that will help you to know if it is truly love.
So it's responsible love.
Yes. And it can be tough love. You know, tough
sure.
love is definitely pointed to in that.
And it's also respecting our differences and loving people for who they need to be rather than who we think they should be.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And that's a tough one for a lot of people. And I, as you know, and you are familiar with human design, we're all designed to be different. And once we can learn to appreciate how different we all are, and each of us is, I always say, we're all living, you're all a spark of God.
Mm-hmm.
And we're living that out individually as unique sparks. And we might not approve of somebody else's spark, but that's their God gift.
Mm-hmm.
and it might shake things up. It might annoy us plenty, but that's what they're here to do.
Yes. Yeah.
In their, what they understand is love.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think our children are wonderful examples of such stimuli to growth.
Right. They push all our buttons.
Yeah, sometimes they do.
And there's nothing wrong with that. We're here for that. They're here for that. It's part of what parenting and being children is about.
Yes, it's such a wonderful gift to be forced to expand in such a beautiful way, to accept somebody else's differences. It's a great gift.
Right, and it challenges what love is.
It does.
Because it challenges our self-esteem, self-worth issues. And I believe that everybody who struggles in life struggles because they have self-love, not because they're lacking it. Mm. But it's their self-love that they feel is lacking in themselves because they're so annoyed with how their lives are working out, what they're lacking in their lives.
Mm.
And they say, well, I'm not good enough. Well, certainly self-esteem and self-worth are harder to come by. And I think self-love is there, and that's what pushes those self-esteem, self-worth buttons.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe love is in everybody.
It is in everybody, and I think the process of awakening to that higher, greater self, one of the gateways is loving yourself and realizing that you do have a dark side, you do have a light side, that there, everybody has these aspects of self, and find some compassion for yourself.
Right.
Which love for yourself then allows that love at the higher, greater being to be accessed in a clearer way, I think.
Right. I think it's more about opening to the self-love that is there,
mm-hmm.
rather than pushing all your lack of self-acceptance in front of it.
Well, yeah, it's like tearing down the walls.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's the whole
process.
And
then the heart shines.
Yes.
It's so beautiful to see that in people.
Yeah, that's so important because you think to sort of achieve, in quotes, Christ consciousness, it requires you to do more or be more, when in fact it requires less. It requires you to tear down the aspects of yourself that are holding the truth of your divinity from you.
Right. And in the book you talk about emotions and how not to judge them.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been a poster child for difficult emotions, I think. And coming to peace with that and realizing that reactivity it's a human condition and it's something that we all have. And so in finding some compassion for myself, if I do react instead of respond, that self-compassion is the only way I'm going to get sort of to the next level of finding that Christ divine self-presence.
I agree, and I think we do have to continuously forgive ourselves.
Oh, it's a very important tool on the journey because if we don't have forgiveness for ourselves, vibrationally, we sort of lower our vibration when we start bashing ourselves, when this path is really about raising our vibration, raising our frequency, raising our sight to that higher divine aspect of ourselves.
So it's about lightening up about our struggles.
Yes, yes. And that's a really important aspect of it, you know, taking it lightly.
Well, what comes to my mind is with you is that it's easier to hold that when spirits are speaking to you from places that are esteemed and they call themselves Jesus or whatever, and you say, my gosh, if these spirits are talking to me, I must be okay.
Yeah, but you know what the problem is? We forget. I forget. You know, part of coming on this human journey is we come into these heavy bodies and we forget that we are all one. We forget that we are of divine essence and origin. And we get caught up in the outer world, the five senses, when this journey to the Christ within is about the internal journey. It's about going inward. I mean, that's where I have found this connection, that love, the resources of the internal presence, the stillness that I carry in the outer world.
Well, your book is so full of exercises and ways of relating to nature and to ourselves, and not only nature, but even whatever environment we're in a resourceful, spiritual way that allows us to go into more of the magic of life. To live more in the magic of life is so perfect. Mm. and you talk about, for instance, being in a room where you're watching the empty space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now that, you know, and then you become the empty space.
Yeah.
And then what happens next?
Well, yeah, I think you're referring to the back of the book, the series of exercises to help you expand mm-hmm. the definition of who you are.
Uh-huh.
I did say, you know, I hadn't had the experience of becoming invisible, because that one is called the invisible exercise. And those exercises were given to me by some gnomes in the woods during a series of visits there. But yes, focusing on that which is the same within everything. If you imagine those pictures in the science books of your childhood where there's, you know, circulating electrons and such, there's space between those little particles of matter. And that space is the same within everything. You know, within the asphalt of the road, within the tree, within my body.
It's all space.
It's space.
There's
and
really
it's
no matter. It's only energy and space.
Right. So if you focus on that, you know, what you focus on becomes stronger and greater in your awareness in many ways. So focusing on the empty space in the room, focusing on, you know, the plant as part of yourself, focusing on whatever is in front of you and focusing on that which is the same in everything. Within it, your definition of who you are can expand to that item, which then shifts your physiology, your perspective, your identity. It's a really beautiful place to find yourself in.
Now I want to get to that place that you talk about and how to do this through intention.
Well,
because here we have an audience that's listening to this and say, okay, I want that. How do I get there?
Right.
And we have a couple minutes left.
Okay. When I asked Jesus what, at a spiritual level, was the most important thing to, you know, allow Christ consciousness to manifest in your life, what was said? That all you needed to do was set your intention to embody Christ consciousness. And that was the strongest thing that you could do of any of these
right.
items.
And I would interpret that also, for instance, as Krishna consciousness or whatever else
yes, thank you.
Is mm-hmm. universal
mm-hmm.
consciousness.
Buddha
consciousness, right?
Yes.
Right. And you know, it's a wonderful intention to have, and just surrender to it after
mm-hmm.
you hold it.
Yeah. And obviously revisiting it and recommitting mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. it, for me, I find important, because I find I do need reminders. You know, having a sacred practice of meditation or a sacred place in the house would just remind you, oh yes, that which is within me, that is, you know, the Christ consciousness. That is what I choose to embody, you know, as I go out my door today.
That's
you know?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful. So let's encourage everybody to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we only have a very short time to talk about that you're the author of Be the Second Coming, Hope Ives Mauran, Mauran. And your website is?
www.bethesecondcoming.com.
Oh, good.
Yeah, simple.
And they can reach you through that?
Yes. Yes, they can.
Okay. This has been such a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm so glad you could... I'm so glad you wrote this book, and I'm so glad you are who you are. And thank you, Hope, for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. It's such a a blessing to be here with you and have this opportunity to share.
Thank you. Yeah. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at Progressive Radio Network, and I can be reached at Peter at HeartRiver, HEART River.org, and thank you so much for listening.